Shalom, I'm David Yehuda Stern, and welcome to a brand new season of the Progressively Jewish Podcast. Each episode of this monthly series coincides with Rosh Chodesh, the start of a new Jewish month, and is an opportunity to explore and connect to Judaism through a progressive lens. The month of Cheshvan begins on Wednesday evening, the 6th of October, and to welcome in the new month, we have a great conversation planned. The mystical text of the Zohar, the central body of literature of the Kabbalah, likens the moon to the Shekhinah, the feminine aspect of God. For hundreds of years, Rosh Chodesh has been considered as particularly sacred to women, providing a space for creativity, sanctity, and personal expression. How has this connection between Rosh Chodesh and women developed through time and space? How has femininity and womanhood, as connected to the festival, been expressed and celebrated? To explore these questions and more, I am joined by two amazing guests, Rabbi Debbie Young Summers of Edgware and Hendon Reform Synagogue, and Eleanor Davis, student rabbi at Leo Beck College. Thank you very much, both of you, for being here. As we are recording this, it's a very wet and windy evening. I can hear the wind howling outside my house. It's also relatively late for a recording, but we're in the middle of a bit of a petrol crisis at the moment, and I think it's affecting the roads. And we're also just at the end of all of the Chagim. So as we come to the end of the month of Tishrei, probably a pretty busy month for the two of you, I wanted to ask you, are you looking forward to Rosh Chodesh? I'll ask Eleanor first.
Thank you. I'm looking forward to Rosh Chodesh. I have to say it's been a pretty good month as these things go. You're talking about the weather this evening, but on Yom Kippur afternoon, I was with a small community and up in Hull, we went and sat outside during the afternoon to do some study together. For Sukkot, we managed to, down in Southampton, have some services and celebrations out in somebody's garden. So I feel that we've been incredibly lucky with some of the weather that's let us celebrate, come together in really COVID safe ways and also enjoy things. I'm looking forward to Rosh Chodesh, but I confess that I think we're all maybe just a little bit tired and needing just to find some extra oomph from somewhere that I'm not quite sure where it's coming from yet.
I definitely feel you there. Rabbi Debbie.
Yeah, I think that end of the hug exhaustion is very real. And of course, life doesn't stop while the hugim go on. People continue to die and people still want to start planning weddings and have bar mitzvahs and talk to their communities and pray. And, you know, this is a wonderful, wonderful job to be in. But I do think that we might need to instigate kind of a week off after the month of Tishrei for all clergy and possibly for their support in synagogue leadership too, who also do an awful lot to make sure it all happens. But thinking about what Eleanor was saying about the weather, you know, this week, next year we will only just be starting Rosh Hashanah, because of course we have an extra month this year. We've got an extra Rosh Chodesh, and we have been so blessed, particularly for Sukkot this year, to be able to not have any meals rained off. I can't remember a year like it, and I suspect next year will be very, very different, because it will be almost an entire month later in the Gregorian calendar.
Last year my sukkah blew down so many times and had to rebuild it, so yeah, this was welcome. I also feel like I really got a good use of it. I got, I think, one meal in it last time. This time was all of them. It was great.
We barely bothered to decorate last year because the forecast was so awful. We put it up and we ate in it when we could, but it wasn't our normal joyous decorated sukkah. And we didn't have lots of guests like we normally would.
I think some people have a custom of intentionally not decorating their sukkah, so not to take away from the mitzvah, the beautiful observance of just making a booth. I assume that was the reason why you didn't decorate it. We just had a load of festivals, and it's funny, when I'm talking to people we often say, oh, well, the next festival is Hanukkah, quite a way away. But I guess that's not really true. We have Rosh Chodesh, which, is it a festival? Is it not a festival? I'm not really sure. Eleanor, how do you think of Rosh Chodesh?
That's so interesting, that question. Is it a festival? Is it... it's definitely not just any ordinary day, that's for certain. It's a really good way of, for me, anchoring myself in the Jewish calendar, even in a different way from Shabbat, because Shabbat rolls around every week, and that's great. But to keep yourself anchored in that sense of where we are in the year, Rosh Chodesh is really quite special for that as well. I have to say, we'll probably talk later about the fact that Rosh Chodesh has been traditionally a women's holiday. Again, like the Chagim that we've just had, for me, Rosh Chodesh is anything but a holiday, because it's usually the time when I do loads of extra teaching and getting together with people, which is fabulous. But it hasn't yet for me quite turned into a holiday in the sense of a break from work.
I a few things that I find interesting there. One, which is in the Gregorian calendar, January, February, March, we don't really make a big deal about each first of the new month, maybe except for April Fools and January 1st. It's not really such a big deal. So I do wonder why we make a big deal of it.
I think there are overhanging superstitions around the first of the month. There's the whole school ritual of pinch punch the first of the month and no returns. And I haven't looked into it, but my assumption is that that ties into some ancient sort of Anglo superstition or Celtic superstition. And this was a sort of way of warding off evil for the coming month or something, who knows. I mean, I think Shabbat is a festival, right? We have a festival every week. I was actually discussing this with a Christian clergy friend today. You know, when we go to synagogue and services and cook meals and have guests over, it's almost like a Christmas or an Easter every week. So there's this sort of weekly festival spirit, and of course Rosh Chodesh doesn't feel like that, but it could if it was sort of observed in ways that it has been suggested in the ancient world. You know, it was supposed to be a time when women had a break, and it was a time for women to cease from housework. And I think that sense of a time and space that is different to other days is almost the raison d'etre of what it means to live in a Jewish cycle of time, is to have these moments of sacredness that are different.
You know, I remember actually growing up, I grew up in an Orthodox Jewish community, and I do remember Rosh Chodesh already being defined in that community as being unique or special for women as well. And it's funny because I think sometimes the way we frame it does sound quite progressive when I'm in conversations with people. But I actually remember the teaching, and I looked up where it came from. It came from Pirkei d'Rabbi Eliezer, which I think we say is written in Tanaitic times, but it's probably written in 8th or 9th century Italy. And it's the story about the golden calf when the Israelites are asking for gold, and they tell Aharon to gather gold, and then Aharon doesn't want this to happen, so basically goes to the women and says, they want to take your gold to build this golden calf, and the women refuse to do that. And I think in that text it says, and as a reward for this, there's this special link with Rosh Chodesh. And I think the particular thing there was that they are stringent not to work on Rosh Chodesh, is kind of the thing that is connected with the women refusing to build the golden calf or contribute to it.
And I love that story, partly because it just endlessly amuses me, the idea that women not handing over their jewelry would be an act of righteous chesed. I'm not giving you my jewelry. You know, I don't care what you want to do with it. It's mine. They're my earrings. You leave my jewelry alone. And I get rewarded for that. That's awesome.
The other bit of Midrash, though, that I love in connection with potentially women and Rosh Chodesh is going back to the Talmudic story of the Rosh Chodesh observances as a compensation to the moon for having to be made smaller than the sun. And I think there's something really interesting there about the power dynamics of a powerful majority something and something that is lesser, or at least accorded less power, being given something as an extra. And that's a really interesting thought for me as well, to parallel that golden calf story.
Yeah, I agree. You know, and I think that story makes me very conscious of how, in a way, uncomfortable or awkward I felt in preparing this podcast episode. Rabbi Debbie, who is also one of the producers, we kind of fleshed out the overall structure of the next season. And we always knew that we wanted this episode to be on Rosh Chodesh and women, but not identifying as a woman, you know, I find it quite hard to think of the questions. I also realized how little I know about this area. So it's actually really fascinating. Kind of, I have quite a long list of questions that I wanted to explore, and it's just interesting to have my mind opened. I'll tell you one thing that I was also thinking about when we were looking at this. I was, if Rosh Chodesh is a women's festival, or sacred to women's festival, what does that make all the other festivals? And then I realized the implications of that, which are probably very true.
Seeing as you mentioned, if I can just pick up on that as well, you mentioned that it's sometimes seen as quite a progressive thing. I think what's really interesting for me is the knowledge that we're now familiar with the announcement and the blessing that's in our Siddurim for Rosh Chodesh, that's in many communities read just on the Shabbat before Rosh Chodesh comes around. That announcement and that blessing was not in the first British progressive prayer books. It was not in the early West London synagogue prayer book. It was not in the first liberal. And it's only in the 60s and 70s that announcement comes into the prayer books even. And so it's interesting how something that's come into the broader prayer space, because that's being announced in a place that's not just for women, it's being announced in a community service in general, and yet there is that tie-in with women, because it's hard to escape the idea that if it was coming in the 60s and 70s, thinking about what's happening in the women's movements in those decades, it's really interesting how that's impacted the wider Jewish community. So this is not something that's only for women, even though it has often been particularly for women.
And actually, I would almost say that what has become more progressive about our observance of Rosh Chodesh by and large, although it varies, is that in some cases it's a space still for women to come and be creative together. But in many spaces, we're actually saying this is the new moon. Anyone who wants to come and learn or ritualize or be part of this, come. When I was at Leo Beck, I wanted to start a Rosh Chodesh group. And I really felt a need for female space at the time. I remember going to my spiritual director, Rabbi Marsha Plum, and saying, I feel really uncomfortable about the idea of creating a women-only space. That doesn't feel right in a progressive setting where I expect to be included in everything. And her response was, well, you know, they had the Rabbinic Assembly for 2,000 years, so you can have a Rosh Chodesh group for a couple of years. But actually, you know, in honoring Rosh Chodesh today, by and large, I do tend to do it in egalitarian spaces where men and women can. I think those binaries are also breaking down in so many ways. And I want to learn from everyone wherever they sit on a gender spectrum. And I want to be able to create learning and sacred space with whoever wants that. And yet there is also still something quite powerful about women's responses to finding parts of Judaism that were designed to speak to them, because I think we're so unused to finding that. And it does sometimes take a bit of digging. It's one of the things that I think Eleanor is particularly brilliant at. That excavating of female voices from our past, they're there, but it does sometimes take a bit more work. I remember one of our colleagues, Rabbi Leah Mulstein, asked about 2 years ago, I think, both the liberal and reform rabbis on an e-group, who had quoted women in their High Holy Day sermons. And I went through my High Holy Day sermons and was horrified at the lack of female voices from my own sermons, because it's so easy to look at Rashi and Rambam and, you know, the obvious sources. And it has made me much more mindful to actually say, okay, where are the diverse voices? Am I just turning to the same old sources? And I hope I'm getting better at it.
I think I remember a conversation that we had, Rabbi Debbie, where we were talking about, you know, me doing a program on women's voices. And I think I said, oh, I don't know if I'd feel comfortable doing that, you know. And I think you rightfully pointed out to me, and you said, I've been doing programs all about men's voices for ages, and it's not been a problem. And you meant it very lovingly. You know, that was.
But also, if it's only women making space for women's voices, that's a problem.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the most powerful things we can do, is by extending the reach of these spaces, but still focusing on those voices that haven't been heard as much throughout history. We're reclaiming those voices, not just for ourselves as those who identify as women, but actually for the whole of Judaism. And that's really, really important, that those voices become part of the whole people, not just something that only those people should concern themselves with.
I agree. One of the things that my conversations with you have been inspired is to, I'm only purchasing books by non-male authors at the moment. And, you know, my bookshelf is very male orientated, especially in the Judaica department. So it's very interesting to hear a different perspective. And it's making my bookshelf and my writings more interesting. So it's great. I wonder if, just for a second, I guess just on a practical note, that we should just explain a little bit about how the Jewish calendar works and why it's so linked with the moon. I guess maybe in our group it seems very obvious, but the Gregorian calendar is predominantly a solar calendar, but we're also not an Islamic calendar where we're entirely lunar based either. So I just wondered if you could just, either of you be happy to just quickly say, what is the connection between Jewish months and the moon?
So there's this Babylonian model of a day of rest on the sort of new moon showing itself. But I think for me, what's so beautiful about how ridiculously complicated our calendrical calendar is, and that's not a phrase either, our calendrical calculations are, is that our cycles are intimately bound up with agriculture. We can't have Pesach in December. It has to be at spring. We can't have the Festival of Lights in July. It wouldn't make sense. It wouldn't work. And so the solar cycles have to offset the lunar cycles to keep us on an agricultural cycle that ultimately connects us to the land and the farming that we came from thousands of years ago. You know, it seems very odd in October to sit in our wet, drippy sukkah and pray for rain. But in the lands from which we came thousands of years ago, that made much more sense. And actually, we're praying for rain there, not for rain here.
So I think what's also, people would may know, may not know, the way then that we compensate and we keep ourselves in tune with those agricultural cycles is by leap months. And I think for people not familiar with the Jewish calendar, that can be a bit of a strange concept, because we're used to the idea of a leap year where you put an extra day in, but we get a whole extra month. And that's quite exciting. And that happens seven times in every 19-year cycle. So we've just had a really, really early month of Chagim. And as Rabbi Debbie said at the beginning, next year it's going to be really late. And that's because we're going to insert that leap month that just helps us keep pretty much in sync with the seasons, but does shift our festivals around a little bit.
I think that makes sense. One of the things that I wanted to talk about was the opportunities that Rosh Chodesh has provided and what rituals it's inspired. And Eleanor, I will confess that when I Googled you before this, you get a YouTube video of you running a Rosh Chodesh group from about 7 months ago that appears. So it was very interesting to watch and very relevant. But Eleanor, what do you find that you're doing on Rosh Chodesh? What are the way you're marking the new month?
So for me now, what I'm usually doing is studying predominantly women's voices and or issues that relate directly to women, with, depending on where I am, either a mixed group or a group of women, and they have slightly different feelings, those. I'm not usually running Rosh Chodesh groups as a pure spiritual experience, and there are some wonderful groups doing fabulous things at the moment as a very personal spiritual experience. Mine is usually with a more educational slant, trying to help people to connect with that particular aspect of Judaism or Jewish things that they may or may not know about. So in recent months, we've had study sessions on particular biblical women, but we've also done study around, for example, the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire in America a whole century ago, or we've looked at issues of menstruation through the Holocaust. And some of those things are maybe what you wouldn't get chance to study in a mainstream study session, but in a Rosh Chodesh, when the focus can turn a bit more to women, that's what we have chance to discuss.
And what do you hope to draw out there? Is it about menstruation, the unique aspect of a particular body, or is it more about femininity, which we may think of as more socially and culturally constructed?
I think what we're trying to find often is ways for women and other people who are interested to be there to connect with Judaism in alternatives to the male traditional text study mode. There may be some strong similarities, but there's also there's just an increase in the diversity of voices and in the perspective. So it's about seeking ways to connect that may not be accessible to everybody, or that people may not feel they particularly connect through with some of the more traditional ways of study, and sometimes even with traditional prayer modes.
I actually think that you've just created a beautiful evening of conversation, David Hidda, of, you know, where is the interconnection of menstruation and femininity and our ability to have those conversations. You know, I'm someone who, as a specialist in mikvah and nidah, talks about menstruation quite a lot, and you know, my children just let it float over them because they're used to it. But for most people, for most men actually, to just raise the subject of menstruation is unusual, and to sit and have those conversations and to connect them to our Judaism and to a tradition that really does care about those cycles, I think is really special.
Can I then ask you, Rabbi Debbie, what are the things that you find are making Rosh Chodesh meaningful, or the things that are inspiring these conversations for you to happen?
So for me personally, the Rosh Chodesh groups that I've been involved with and have helped facilitate have typically looked at our ritual lives, but have really studied them and drilled down into them, and then have tried to make those rituals accessible and personal. So it might be something as simple and obvious as tallit or kippot, but something that actually we might consider gendered, we might not, something that we might take for granted, and to really go into some of the stories of those items or those rituals and flesh them out and make them real, so that when we live them, they're much more meaningful beyond Rosh Chodesh. And I don't think that is necessarily limited to one gender, right? Anyone can benefit from that kind of drilling down in a space where everyone is welcome to explore. But I think, you know, learning has always been a part of any Rosh Chodesh group I've been a part of. Sometimes there's been a spiritual ritual element marking Rosh Chodesh each time, and sometimes there hasn't. But actually, just by doing something that is focused on the fact that it is Rosh Chodesh, either today or around this time, you're taking the time to honor the cycles that we live through. In a way that otherwise they just passes by so easily. and it's another sort of opportunity to connect.
And those opportunities to connect with ritual things are something that I especially first accessed in some of the Rosh Chodesh groups that Rabbi Debbie was leading. So it's a really lovely thing. One of the things that I also adore about Rosh Chodesh is that although I access it as a religious feminist, historically since the 70s, it hasn't only been for feminists and it hasn't only been for religious Jews. So some Jewish women who don't particularly want any religious connection have found meaning in it in other ways, whether that's in sisterhood, fellowship, or whether that's through spiritual things that they don't necessarily feel are terribly Jewish. But it's also been a wonderful opportunity for Orthodox women who may have not always sat comfortably with some aspects of feminism, that for some Orthodox women, Rosh Chodesh type observations have been the first places where they've experienced all women tefillah, where they've been able to read from the Torah because they're in a space that for them works and permits those things. So I also really love the cross-denominationalness of Rosh Chodesh.
What are some of the things that one can do to get involved in Rosh Chodesh, be they male, female, or any, or however they identify? Like, where would I go?
I think lots of communities have some kind of Rosh Chodesh group. I think, however, lots and lots of Rosh Chodesh groups are quite organic and start with a group of friends or a group with a common interest who want to try something out. I think if you are going to try something out, give yourself, you know, we're going to do this for 6 months. So you have an off ramp and you can say, you know what, this has been lovely. I've learned something and now we know it's going to finish. Unless everyone says, oh, yes, let's carry on. This was amazing. Because it can be scary to enter into something and feel like you're committing for something. And it may be that actually you just need a bit of time to establish your own Rosh Chodesh ritual or your own practice. Or it might be that it becomes a really valuable part of your learning cycle.
Do either of you have a particular ritual that it would not be Rosh Chodesh if you didn't consider doing?
I'd like to say that I refuse to do the washing up, but I've yet to have the guts to do it.
Well, I would just they're add listening if to I'm this show, so...
If I may just briefly add to Rabbi Debbie's, if you're looking for support to set up your own Rosh Chodesh group, you might be interested to look up the At The Well Project. I believe they're at thewellproject.com, who are designed to help people in setting up their own, they call them well circles, but certainly to help you get started on thinking about that is really good. And there's also a couple of wonderful books that are worth having a look at. The book called Moonbeams is now 20 years old, but is still a classic and really worth looking up.
It's really 20 years old.
It's 21 years old. Can you imagine? And even older, Penina Edelman's book, Miriam's Well, is also just so worth looking up for just ways to get you started thinking about what you might want to do.
Rabbi Debbie, are there any other books that you think are worth mentioning? Though I will say that Miriam's Well was definitely an inspiration for some of this podcast.
Yeah, I mean, those are the two sort of go-to books that I would definitely recommend. I mean, there are other general wonderful things like, you know, women as ritual creators and specific books that focus on things like women and water and all sorts of other ritual oriented books that will tie into Rosh Chodesh and will mention it. But those two really are created as guides to take you on at least a journey of a year.
I'm really intrigued. I would like to attend a Rosh Chodesh group, but I won't lie, like my initial sense is, would I be an imposter in that group as a man? And is that a valid concern or no? And do you two feel like imposters in other groups by being women?
Oh, I almost always feel like an imposter. Do I feel like an imposter? The place I most feel like an imposter is quite often at interfaith meetings where I get invited because I am or was relatively young and female, and they wanted to somehow balance out all the beardiness in the room. And I quite often felt myself underqualified, but somehow became qualified because I kept being asked in. And I think actually being allowed in qualifies you. It kind of ties into a story that is very much of Eleanor and mine at the moment, in a way. So Eleanor has spent the last decade teaching the EHRS Rosh Chodesh group, with many others welcomed from beyond the synagogue, taking incredibly deep looks at different women's stories and figures from the Bible, figures of protest, as you were saying earlier. And after 10 years of dedication, Ellen has decided to step down and has passed the mantle to me. And I'm shifting things to make it much more ritually oriented, because that's what I know and what's what I turn to. And we'll see where it goes with the group. Now, the group who've been gathering with Eleanor has been a mixed group. And there were lots of concerns. Would Debbie let men come? Would it be a female only space? And I'm delighted to have anyone come. So you'd be very welcome, DY, and anyone else. But I think the whole issue of feeling as an imposter is an entirely whole different episode that we could talk about. The whole issue as clergy of imposter syndrome, I think, is fascinating. There are spaces in which I think you would not be welcome, and there are spaces in which I would not be welcome. But if it's a space in which you're allowed in, then you're not an imposter.
That is beautifully. But well, Rabbi Debbie, can I attend the next one that's coming up?
You can.
Great. I think that'd be then lovely to then come back on the show and talk about it. But I'd love to actually experience it rather than.
Maybe we'll just play this episode for them.
I guess the last thing I wanted to kind of end on, and we touched upon it earlier, is Judaism leaves a legacy of androcentricity. It's dominated by male perspectives and points of views. And I think in some ways, Rosh Chodesh, as we've been discussing it, challenges that. But I think there's also that other challenge that has been going on for a long time, which is to do with the notionary of binary as gender, which Rabbi Debbie, you touched on right at the beginning. I just wonder how either of you see that affecting this kind of unique aspect of Rosh Chodesh. I definitely see it affecting all aspects of Jewish life. In our liturgy, we're rethinking an awful lot about what do we do with liturgy, which seems to present God in a way, which does present God in very male, typically male language or masculine language. I have to say, even as we're saying all of this, I find that I trip over the use of masculinity, femininity, male, female, man, woman. And, I feel an imposter syndrome talking about this, because I'm still trying to navigate for myself exactly how to talk about gender, knowing that a lot of these challenges to gender seem to make sense to me. But I wanted to just get your thoughts on that, as maybe connected to Rosh Chodesh.
I think all of us have different needs when it comes to learning, when it comes to spirituality. And we need to find spaces in which we can have those needs met. And that won't be the same for everyone. For some, it will be binary spaces. For others, it will be mixed spaces. For some, it will be, you know, very cerebral. For others, it will be very spiritual. For others, it will be a mix in between. And not every space will speak to every person. And I think we live at a very exciting time of Jewish life, when incredible diversity is available to us if we search, and even more so in a world where so much is now available online. That has really opened so many doors.
Thank you,
I think, Ellen. Perhaps one of the things that we've learned over the past 50 years of Rosh Chodesh groups is that if there isn't a space where you fit yet, you can create one, because that's what women started doing, especially from the 70s, were saying, well, if I don't find a space that's meaningful for me, okay, let's get together and create one. And I hope that's what everybody will feel empowered to do, is to take up Rosh Chodesh as whatever it means to you, and to create a space in which you do feel that you can access the meaningful Jewish tradition that speaks to you.
I think those are beautiful notes to end on. We're out of time. That brings us to the end of this podcast. Thank you to our amazing guests, and also to Liberal Judaism, Reform Judaism, and Leo Beck College for supporting Progressively Jewish. Don't forget to subscribe to the Progressively Jewish podcast and to leave us a positive comment or review with your podcast provider. We hope that you will recommend us to your friends and fellow congregants, those who are Jewish and people of all faiths and none. To share your ideas on the future of this podcast, either comment on the Progressively Jewish Facebook page or email us at progressivelyjewish@gmail.com. In next month's episode, for the month of Kislev, we will be reflecting on the Imahot, the matriarchs of our tradition.